briefing following at least part of our morning sessions. We've still got one session that's in progress. The organic session is still in progress, and we will have Dr. Eglinton and Dr. Taylor joining us from that session as soon as they're finished. Also, the geochemistry session is finishing up. I think they have they're on their final paper there. So let me introduce the gentleman that we have, and we'll be joined by, I think, about three more. To the right is Dr. Bruce Doe. To his immediate right is Dr. David Wones of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Doe is of the U.S. with the U.S. Geological Survey, on loan to NASA, and I believe returning to USGS soon. And on the end of the table here to my immediate left is Dr. Eugene M. Cameron, C-A-M-E-R-O-N, of the University of Wisconsin. And we'll have a short summation from each of these gentlemen as to the highlights of their own papers or of the session that they participated in, and then we'll take your questions. Dr. Doe, I think if you could start on the geochemistry session.
I'm a little bit unhappy to talk without George Wetherill being here.
I'm sorry. Yes, I had talked with Dr. Doe before. We were going to leave him till last in the hopes that Dr. Wetherill would be able to join us, so we'll start down here on the right with Dr. Cameron.
Well, I belong to the group of scientists who have been studying the opaque minerals, the oxides of iron and titanium and chromium, and combinations of iron with sulfur and native iron itself, the opaque metallic minerals in the lunar rocks. And I think that the morning session has shown that there's very close agreement among the findings of the various investigators. Again, as in Apollo 11, we have evidence of the prominence of titanium in the lunar rocks of the Maria, although the content of titanium in the Apollo 12 rocks is substantially lower than in the Apollo 11 rocks. But we also have, again, confirmation of the fact that the oxygen and water content of the lunar systems from which these basaltic rocks crystallized was extremely low. They're oxygen deficient, and they're also rather must have been very low in sulfur. We have iron in the reduced condition, so strongly reduced that we get native metal, which is very uncommon in comparable rocks, silicate rocks, in terrestrial systems. And we have, I think, evidence for the first time that these strongly reducing conditions, oxygen deficient conditions, characterize the entire process of crystallization. That is, these systems were oxygen deficient right from the beginning of crystallization, whereas we could be absolutely sure of this in the Apollo 11 rocks only in the latter stages of crystallization. Now, it is quite clear, I think, that the bulk chemistry and courses of crystallization in the Apollo 12 basaltic rocks are somewhat different from those in Apollo 11, and this is recorded simply in somewhat different mineral assemblages. The most interesting minerals found, opaque minerals found in the Apollo 12 rocks, are of the very complex group that we call the spinels. These are very complex oxides of iron, titanium, chromium, aluminum, magnesium, and a bit of manganese. And I think that when we've had a chance to digest the findings of all the investigators, they are going to tell us a great deal about what has been happening chemically during the crystallization of these rocks. We already have considerable information, of course. But I think those are the main findings of the group that has been studying the opaque minerals.
Okay, very good. Dr. Wands?
The second half of this morning's session was devoted mainly to the silicate minerals, which, of course, are the most dominant minerals both on the moon and on the Earth. what we basically saw were some very careful X-ray diffraction studies and electron microscopy and electron diffraction studies. These all enable us to see down into the very smallest domains of these crystals, and this is contributing a great deal to our understanding of the crystallization histories of these crystals, and basically a better understanding of just how they are built up on an atomic basis. For those of us in crystallography and mineralogy, this is really exciting because we're really getting a much better understanding than we ever had before. And one of the fallouts of the Moon program, of course, has been that this means we understand the terrestrial minerals and rocks to a much greater extent than we have previously. The final paper was my own of the morning, and what we attempted to do in this paper was to look at whether or not one would expect to find hydrous minerals on the Moon. And we took a look at the one amphibole, which had been described previously by the Cambridge group last year from Apollo 11, and we decided that it is very rich in halogen minerals, fluorine and chlorine, substitute for it, as they do in the apatites, and this means that the water content of any lunar process is just about zero. And in fact, and I went through my paper and tried to go through all the information, all the evidence from both the 11 and 12 experimenters on why the Moon is so dry. It very definitely is dry. There's no evidence for any water at all from the Moon itself. And most of the hydrogen that's been reported appears to be from the solar wind or from contamination. And that means that we're back to a model of the Moon, which is without water. This means that the interior of the Moon is probably somewhat stronger than the interior of the Earth. And it means that, in other words, that the rocks and things that make up the Moon probably are a little stronger than they are on the Earth, the lack of water. And it means that the melting temperatures of igneous rocks on the Moon are much higher than they are equivalently on the Earth. Because water is a tremendous fluxing agent and lowers the temperatures and melts. So we would expect then the Moon to have lost its volcanism early in the stage and not go on for a long period of time with cooling temperatures, as there's no water to help keep the processes going. Tying back in with Dr. Cameron's comments on the oxide studies, the oxide minerals also show these very reducing trends. We see no ferric iron at all. And water, again, is a very good oxidation agent. If we have any water around, we usually oxidize iron up to Fe plus 3. You're all familiar with rust and that problem. And we don't see anything like that in any of the lunar materials. And so this, again, indicates that the Moon has been very dry and always has been exceedingly dry.
Yes. If I could make one comment on the consequences of this. I happen to be an economic geologist concerned with mineral deposits, and we know very well that on Earth, water plays a tremendous role in producing the great variety of mineral deposits on which we draw for our mineral raw materials. If we took water out of terrestrial systems, the range of types of mineral deposits that could be formed on Earth would be far more limited than it is, and we would be without some of the kinds of deposits that are our main reliance at the present time. So when we look at the evidence for the total lack of any water on the Moon, at least in the rocks in the outer part of the Moon, it's a little bit discouraging when one thinks of the prospect for finding a great range of mineral resources on the Moon. It doesn't seem that at this point, at least, unless we can get entirely different information from future expeditions, that we will have much of a variety of mineral deposits on the Moon, or at least a variety comparable to those on Earth.
Dr. Dahl?
I'll deal a bit more with the geochronology on the Moon. I think that with regard to a number of people in age determination business, that there's been quite a bit of shaking out at this meeting. I think the rubidium strontium dating speakers have showing that most of the rocks on the Moon apparently were derived from a parent that was about 4.5 billion years old. The exception the clear exception being the high potassium basalts from Apollo 11. I think in the soil studies on the lead isotopes and picking the soil apart, the way I would interpret the lead isotope data and the way I think most people in this business would be that we are dealing with soil that was derived from a source that is about 4.6 billion years old, not particularly significantly different from the rocks. It might be, it might not, maybe 4.7 billion years old, and that there are some components in the soil that are much younger, maybe something on the order of 3.5 billion years old. However, the main event at 3.5 billion years perhaps was a differentiation in which some phases got enriched in lead over uranium and other phases were depleted. In other words, I think that the rubidium-strontium rock studies and the lead isotope soil studies, and also to a great extent the rubidium-strontium soil studies, are supporting a source for all these materials at around 4.6 billion years, and it's still an extrapolation perhaps to say that's the age of the moon, but one perhaps would be forgiven if one felt that it must be close to that. I think the second interesting thing to me in the dating today was that in the soil studies on Apollo 12, the lead isotope configurations were quite different from those on Apollo 11. And there's an indication, as many other studies seem to have indicated, that there might be a significant component of some substance like rock 12013, or something that I found interesting is the growth and reporting of these high potassium, high silica glasses. It appears that whatever this component is in the soil, that it's a good deal younger than 3 billion years, and that we're in, at this stage, there's no way of narrowing it down much more than that, but it could be near zero, it could be somewhat over a billion years, but at any rate considerably younger, and no one quite knows what this is. One of the studies by Tatsumoto where he tried to separate the soil apart indicated that the discordant phase was in a group of minerals that contained scoriaceous glass and feldspar. This might be possibly due to younger meteorite impacts. I don't know, but it does contribute a lot of the lead to the soil. 10% of this material would contribute about 90% of the lead to the soil. So I think the interesting thing here is that is the beautiful variety that we're getting in the Apollo 12 rocks. They're looking wonderfully complex. Which is a joy and a challenge to the scientist.
Let me introduce the two gentlemen who just joined us. Next to Dr. Doe is Dr. Wetherill, Dr. George W. Wetherill of the University of California in Los Angeles, and down on the end of the table is Dr. Gerald R. Taylor of the Manned Spacecraft Center. Gentlemen, we're asking each of the participants to give a brief summation of their own paper or of the session that they participated in. Dr. Wetherill, if you could pick it up there.
Okay, I was at the same session that Bruce Doe talked about, so I'll, rather than trying to cover the whole session, I'll just try to pick out what seemed to me the highlights and in general what the present state of things are. I think we have to recognize that so far we've only gone to two places on the moon, and to attempt to understand the history of a planet simply by going to two places is an excessively ambitious thing. A much more thorough study of the moon is necessary before loose ends are going to be start to become the smaller rather than larger in number. However, I think it's important to distinguish clearly between hard facts, which have been established even by this limited amount of lunar exploration, and also between this and the new problems which have come about as a consequence of making further measurements. I think the hard facts which have come out from Apollo 12, that's distinct from Apollo 11 with regard to the age determination, is that we are clearly not dealing with a single time at which most lunar rocks were formed. From Apollo 11, all we really had for sure were 3.6 billion year old rocks. Now we see in a very similar, geologically very similar terrain in the Apollo 12 site, clear 3.3 billion year old rocks. This means that various classes of theories regarding the history of the moon involving very special episodes in like such as close approaches to the Earth and so forth are not tenable. We have to deal with a continuous series of lunar volcanic events rather than some specific magic time 3.6 billion years ago. In addition to that, there's rather clear evidence for older rocks at the Apollo 12 site. Whether these are 4.0 or 4.6 billion years old, it's a bit hard to say because of the complexity of the rock types involved. But they're clearly older than 3.6 billion years, which is further evidence that lunar rock production has been something not confined to a single episode, but something spread out over a considerable period of time, of the order of 1.5 billion years at least. In addition to that, as Dr. Doe has concentrated on some of the complexities which have come about, and these complexities are all ultimately related to the fact that in the soil we are seeing material coming from a greater distance than we see from the large pieces of rock which are abundant at the landing site. And I think the ultimate understanding of these various components in the soil will depend upon visiting these other sites from which these materials might come, such as been mentioned yesterday, such as the Fra Mauro Formation, Copernicus, places of this kind. In addition, I think that an important paper that was presented this morning that if you wish to learn more about it, it would be better to talk to the man who presented it, Eberhardt, showed, I think, for the first time a good grouping in the exposure ages. He showed a correlation between a particular rock type, namely the low potassium rock type of Apollo 11, and the exposure ages, thus beginning to fulfill the hope that exposure ages might enable us to identify rocks as coming from a particular crater and having been excavated at a definite point in time. In this case, the time was something like 100 million years ago. And this was a hope that people doing exposure ages had for some time. I think we're beginning to see the realization of it.
Dr. Taylor?
If I can take you over to the organic section for a moment. There were two papers this morning, one by the team at Ames of Oyama and others, and the other by myself, reporting on the search for viable microorganisms in the lunar material. And I think those are the only two papers I'd better talk about from that session. First of all, the Ames group and the MSC group used methods that were complementary to each other. And generally, I think we offered any microorganisms that might have been there a pretty good variety of things to eat. We did not pick up any viable microorganisms from either the Apollo 11 or the Apollo 12 samples. And the Ames group reported the same results. This concerned us a little bit at the MSC because our business is one of quarantine, and we had three problems present themselves, or three reasons why this might have happened. It might have been that there weren't any organisms there, or secondly, they might have been some there and they were inhibited by the lunar material, or thirdly, we might not have been feeding them properly. So trying to find out something about the second assumption, we did some extractions of lunar material and put living organisms in these extractions. And for the fine material of Apollo 11 and for the core material of Apollo 12 and the fine material of Apollo 12, we noticed no effect. However, with the core material of Apollo 12, the microorganisms were killed within 10 hours. This was done for a very common microorganism, Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Next step was to find out if this happened in other microorganisms, and it did, and if it happened in other samples of the same lunar sample, the Apollo 11 core, which it did. The Ames group this morning presented some information where they studied a different sample 11 core. They did not demonstrate any toxicity, but they did demonstrate a loss in pigment production by the same microorganism, working with a different sample. I think I'd better let them explain more about that if you have any questions. The second thing I think that came out of those two papers that you ought to know about is that we have a microorganism that uses iron as an energy source. And we grew this microorganism in such a way that the only iron available to it was from the lunar material. Therefore, it was using the lunar iron as an energy source. I think that's all from those two papers.
Okay, we have one other gentleman who is scheduled to join us. That's Dr. Jeffrey Eglinton, who is one of the session chairmen for the organic session, and he should be along before too much longer, I hope. We'll take your questions now. John, can we get right up here?
For the three gentlemen on this end, what does this tremendous lack of water mean as far as the water hydration is concerned in terms of setting up a base at some future point on the moon? This has been the goal, I gather, of some of the long-term thinkers.
I'd say that if anybody's going to set up a base on the moon, they're going to have to take their water with them from the Earth. I just don't see any other very efficient way to do it. There's not enough water in the soil to do anything. It's just not there. There is some from the solar wind, but it's also very, very small quantities, parts per million.
Arthur?
In line with that, could you compare the dry... say the Gobi or Sahara deserts here, 1,000 times drier than that, or whatever?
That's a pretty tough number to come up with. I'd say 1,000 is probably a very conservative estimate. The Gobi Desert has minerals in it that are hydrous. There are hydrous minerals in the Gobi Desert. They've not lost their water to the water vapor pressures on the Earth. Present lunar surface is indeed a vacuum, and one of the problems we've had is whether the lunar rocks we're looking at have lost their hydrogen to outer space just from being on the surface of the moon in a vacuum. And one of the interesting things that's come out of the papers this morning was the fact that people have not reported water in any kind of combined form in any of the lunar materials that we suspect have been protected from the lunar vacuum by being in the interior of lava flows and things like that. And again, we see no water there at all. So that... The interior of the lunar lava flows is certainly 1,000, perhaps a million times drier than the low water vapor pressures we get in the Earth's atmosphere on desert areas.
Could I just say one thing here?
Sure.
I presume that the people of the press are familiar with a patent that got rather wide circulation a while back, which may be that you eventually won't need to take all your water there. You can take something lighter like hydrogen and possibly convert it into water by breakdown of ilmenite or something using a solar furnace on the moon.
Lou Alexander?
That was my question. Dr. Dole, could you comment any further on that? Could these people, without going too far into speculation, could you say that you could take some equipment from Earth and draw from some of what there is on the moon and thus manufacture water at a little less cost and weight?
Well, I think you know as much about this. All I've done is read the news release, so...
right here, and then we'll come back up to John Lennon.
On the matter of the lack of water, does this support the idea that the moon, the original material, might have been a silicate atmosphere, or so hot that there was nothing in the original material?
I think I refer you to there was a very excellent paper on this subject by Ed Anders in Science Magazine, which he pointed out that an accreting moon, from the lack of all the other volatile elements, you know, all the volatile elements are depleted on the moon, that one would anticipate only getting a layer of water in the initial moon of, what was it, 3 to 4 meters, I believe it was Ed's calculation he came up with. So this means that the original accretion of the moon was indeed a fairly dry event, probably because of it being at an elevated temperature.
That gives me a partial answer to my question, but I think I'd like to be absolutely certain. What you're saying
is that the chemical formation processes that you people have looked into were basically anhydrous in nature. They took place without benefit of water, and that you, even though you find no water there now, it isn't a case of it having escaped into the vacuum.
That's correct. I think that all the evidence that I've seen and that the investigators presented this morning and in other sessions of this meeting and last year's meeting, that all the chemical processes appear to have gone on without the presence of water.
That's one of the lines of evidence for that is the presence of native iron among the opaque minerals, and that apparently started to form at the earliest stages of crystallization of the Apollo 12 rocks, and this wouldn't be possible if any water had been present. The iron would have been oxidized to the ferrous condition or even the ferric condition if any water had been present at all.
What do you mean by native iron? Is it straight Fe?
Yeah, Fe, it has some nickel and cobalt in it, but it's about 96%, most of it, iron, and the rest nickel and cobalt.
The important thing is that this, you see, this, the people reported this morning that this iron is showing up all through the entire crystallization history of these rocks, so that a little bit of water in a melt, as you crystallize the entire melt, that water builds up in concentration, and we see no evidence for this at all. No evidence of any kind of buildup of water concentration during these processes.
Paul Reeser.
Dr. Cameron, what mineral deposit, if any, is totally excluded or totally impossible on the moon in the absence of water?
Well, there'd be whole categories of them, actually, because, for example, we have a whole range of what we call chemical sedimentary deposits that are formed by chemical precipitation in bodies of water on Earth, the seas or lakes, for the most part. We'd have to exclude those completely. Now, when you do that, you take away all our limestone resources right away. You take away a great deal of our iron ores. You take a great deal of our manganese resources, and so on down the line, a number of other things. And we have a whole category of deposits that we call hydrothermal. These are deposits that are formed by solutions rising in the crust, solutions at moderate to moderately elevated temperatures. Water is, we think, the main vehicle of transport of metallic and other substances that are ultimately precipitated in these deposits. We would have to exclude those.
Hey, pardon? Can you give us the names of some of these?
Oh, copper deposits, lead and zinc, a whole battery of metals, actually. Those would be important ones.
Would these conditions lead to specific deposits of other substances which you wouldn't find in say, the structure of the Earth?
I don't know whether we have enough information to answer that yet. If you can put the question in a little different form, it'll be a lot easier for me to answer. Your question's a darn good one, and I wish I could answer it, but we are dealing with the products of crystallization of magmas, and there are certainly certain categories of deposits that could form under magmatic conditions, deposits of chromium, for example, of titanium, of iron, and perhaps, conceivably platinum metals.
What I'd like to do here, Dr. Eglinton has joined us, take about two or three more questions if we have them on the geology session, and then let Dr. Eglinton sum up some of the organic session. Art, did you have?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess this would be for Dr. Doe or Weatherill. As I didn't understand something in Rochelt's paper, maybe you all can explain it to me, about this search for an isomer of thorium 232. And this sort of leads me to a general question about have you all been able to find any isotopes on the moon that don't exist on the Earth, and what possibly this could mean?
That would be unfair. Well, John thought that he had had this isomer a year ago, and he thinks even more a year later that he's got it. He doesn't see it in all the samples. And I think that it's kind of viewed rather speculatively, even by himself. However, if you've... this is the way science progresses. Somebody gets onto an idea and they stick with it, and he's still pursuing it after a year, so at least he's pretty well convinced that there is this isomer of thorium-230.
Have you found any different
ones? No, as a matter of fact, one of the... there are a number of studies that are going on the moon, which you might call swinging for the fence type of studies. There's the quark studies and the monopole studies and the super heavy element studies. I think there's maybe a bit of evidence of plutonium-244. Maybe George can answer about that, but so far none of these that I know have come through. If you know of any other unusual things, really, then maybe...
Well, there are various other things which are hard to explain, which I think the kind of things that usually turn out to be uninteresting, but maybe one time out of 100 do. I'd say that the thing that Rush Holt was talking about is one. The excess U-236 that Fields talked about is another. I think all these things are worth pursuing. On the other hand, they're definitely not really, I'd say, clear evidence of any very, very, very remarkable things happening at this point, but bear in the further study.
Right here.
We're saying a moment ago, in relation to what John Lennon asked about the converse, what types of minerals or elements are found on the moon and not on Earth. One of them, you said, was native iron. Is it likely that you might also find other unoxidized metals, the type of metal that we were talking about, copper deposits, copper sulfate, and so on, which you not expect on the moon? Are you likely to find pure copper metal, pure gold metal, other metals in the unoxidized, unsulfured state?
Well, first on the native iron, I think that from what we've seen in Apollo 12, that under appropriate conditions, where we had very slow cooling, maybe in the thick body of this rock, you certainly might get a deposit, an accumulation of native iron of a magnitude that we wouldn't have on Earth. And this would contain nickel and cobalt, one or the other or both. I think it's not inconceivable that you might find some exotic deposits that we wouldn't find here simply because we have conditions that are too oxidizing. There's another possibility, too. I don't know how good this is. I'm really doing an awful lot of speculation here, as my colleagues will recognize, but we don't have water, but one of the things that Dr. Wonis brought out in his paper this morning was that maybe we have to think of the halogens as playing something of the role in lunar systems that water does in Earth systems, and this leads one to speculate whether you could get some odd kinds of mineral deposits forming because of that. Maybe he'd like to comment on this further. He knows more about this aspect than I do.
Well, the major point was that the two minerals that have been found that normally are water-bearing on Earth, the apatite with calcium phosphate and the amphibole, which is a complex sodium iron magnesium silicate normally with water on Earth, the indications are the lunar amphibole and the lunar apatite are both have fluorine and chlorine in them rather than the hydroxyl groups. So this means then that then this amphibole was precipitated in a vug, which means that presumably it was precipitated out of a vapor that was enriched in the halogens. And so when one has halogens in a pure system like this, then one can get iron chloride and titanium chloride as volatile substances, and one could get small amounts, now not very extensive, but certainly very small on the, say, the centimeter or several millimeter dimensions of transfer of iron and titanium in lunar systems by this means of transfer.
Zach Strickland.
Dr. Cameron, I'd like to bring this thing down about four notches, if I could, so that maybe I can follow you. Are you saying that because of the absence of water, there, based on your findings so far, no mineral deposits worthy of setting up a mining operation on the moon? And by the same token, are you saying that there are perhaps not enough exotic minerals which would not be abundant on Earth to do the same thing on the moon?
Well, on the first part of it, I certainly didn't want to imply there are no mineral deposits on the moon, but only a less variety. You see my point? Because, well, take, for example, some of the minerals that we've been looking at. Let's take the native iron. Now, we have concentrations of metallic minerals formed during the crystallization of magmas on Earth. They include some very important resources of chromite and of vanadium, iron, and titanium. Now, how do we get them? Well, we have to have, generally, we have to have these minerals coming out as oxides, or certain ones as sulfides, early in the game, so that they have a chance to settle and accumulate. Now, you've got in these Apollo 12 rocks, you've got native iron coming out as one of the first, as either the first or one of the first two minerals to form in the rock. So the rest of it was presumably liquid at that time. Those are things of high specific gravity. And under appropriate conditions of slow cooling, with a chance to settle, those would settle right down to the bottom and accumulate, you could have a mineral deposit. But the point I was trying to make is that when you exclude water from the system, you reduce the possible variety of kinds of mineral deposits, some of which I mentioned. All our deposits due to weathering on Earth, for example, our major aluminum resources are produced by weathering at the surface of the Earth. Now, water is absolutely essential for that weathering. We exclude it, no weathering, no bauxite deposits.
So you might get pure metals instead.
No, limited range. The range of these is going to be limited. Okay?
I'd like, if we could at this point, to return for a moment to the organic section and have Dr. Eglinton sum up for us the highlights of that session. We did have Dr. Taylor comment on his paper and the papers, related paper presented by the Ames Group, and if you could kind of sum up the rest of the session for us, or the highlights of it.
Well, we're only halfway through, really, so it's a little difficult to give you an overall picture, but I think the most striking thing that comes out so far is that both Apollo 11 and Apollo 12, but especially Apollo 12, is about the cleanest stuff in terms of organic materials that we normally think of. That you can find anywhere. I mean, if you take Antarctic snows and melt them down, if you take desert sands and extract them, you can find plenty of material with modern sensitive techniques. A few years ago, this wouldn't have been so, but it is now. When we try to do the same thing with the lunar sample, we're pushed down into the parts per billion range. That's 1 in 10 to the 9th. And this means that the arguments are over almost nothing, but the almost nothing is often found to be very interesting by those who are searching for it. So that's the first picture. It's a fantastically clean thing. It's cleaner than most vacuum systems that we can make and maintain on Earth. In terms of organics, it looks pretty filthy, but it's not. Now, the second thing is the contamination problem that LRL and, as anyone else, working laboratories had experienced has been very much improved on Apollo 12 compared with Apollo 11. On Apollo 11, you may remember there were things found in the sample like cellulose fibers, bits of Teflon, and odds and ends of grease. Many of these things, we know how they got in, and the precautions taken have now been stepped up, and the result is that it's much harder to find contaminants in the Apollo 12 samples. So that's a tremendous help to the organic people in nailing down this question of what happens to the element carbon on the moon. And why, of course, we're also interested in the element carbon is not just that it's another element out of all the other, how many we've got now, God knows, it depends on the physicists. The thing is that, of course, carbon is the vital element as regards any living system. So the next point to come to is the search for living systems. Well, here, both the LRL and Ames have made a pretty extensive search using a very, very elaborate series of tests. And the general conclusion they come up with is that it's impossible to find anything under a tremendous range of growing conditions that will grow. Similarly, they do find in odd samples, and only odd samples, this business of bactericidal activity. Until this really gets fully tested by the whole scientific community, I think it's a little difficult to reach any conclusions. There are only very few experiments, but those seem to indicate that there are presumably some components, say be a certain concentration of metals or organic complexes of metals that are formed by reaction with the testing media on the lunar sample that have this bactericidal effect. But anyway, this is something that needs to be followed up and worked out properly. There is also the question of looking for microfossils. As far as I know, as no one has seen anything that looks remotely like a microfossil. Plenty of weird-looking objects under the stereo scan, but nobody wants to ascribe them to a fossil. So we're completely out on living organisms, thank goodness, and we are left with the question now of looking for living organisms by another method, and that method is the method of the organic chemists, where you look for the carbon compounds that would normally be synthesized on Earth by living systems. And if we take one of our fingers and dump it on a glass thing, we immediately get a tremendous range of organics deposited there, and with modern sensitive techniques, you could take a tiny fragment of that beaker if you broke it and analyze it, and you would detect amino acids and all sorts of things and say, aha, someone has touched this. So we tried all this with the lunar sample. When I say we, the whole range of us doing different things have tried this on the lunar sample, and with Apollo 12 being much cleaner, we can now tie things down more firmly. And the result is that the things that are really rather indicative of life, such as nucleic acids, certain hydrocarbons, amino acids, porphyrins, are generally not detectable at the levels that people are working. And these levels are often, as I've said, something like 10 to the minus 9, one part in a billion. However, there is, I believe, to come this afternoon some disagreement amongst people, but again, it will be fighting over very small amounts of material. So I think the general consensus there is that there's nothing much indicative of living organisms when looked at by this particular search method, that of the organic chemists. Now, I would remind you that this sort of search is going to be made in the Viking mission to Mars. So here we have a testing ground, in effect, with the lunar samples. The next thing, the last thing possibly that I should really try to say, is that one of the searches that the organic people wanted to make was to see what happened to carbon under the peculiar conditions on the moon, assuming no living organisms. And because this is a very interesting thing. On our own planet, presumably, we started off without living organisms at the beginning. The conditions were very different. Place was knee-deep in water and so on. But on the moon, we have a very different experiment, but an interesting one nonetheless. Well, in looking to see, what we find is that we have small amounts of gases, such as methane, very small amounts, the order of a few parts per million. We have carbides, which are also detected by the mineralogists. The great game now is to try and find out how those things got there and what they mean. Can they tell us anything about the events on the moon, which would perhaps substantiate some of the other areas found by the more physical colleagues or the more geochemical ones? Or can they tell us something quite different that they have not been able to reach? Well, this is the stage I think we're now entering, where the very high sensitivity techniques of the, some of the people concerned, the high-resolution mass spectroscopists and so on, these are now being applied to try to discriminate between the different sites of deposition of these carbon compounds in the lunar samples. If we can find out where they are and what type they are and their isotope ratios and so on, we may be able to learn something about how much has come from the carbon and the hydrogen has come from the sun, how much has come from meteorites, how much from volcanic activity, how much was in the rock to start with. And this game is really only just beginning now. In Apollo 12, we've got the preliminary results with these more sophisticated techniques. So I think we will find something of considerable value, not what perhaps most people expected us to find, which was the biolipids or the absence of them, but something more closely connected with the inorganic geochemist and with the physicist. And this is a development of a new area of organic chemical type of science. I think that's a summary so far.
Okay, let's start over here. John Wilford.
A couple of questions. One, when you were talking about the bactericidal activity, did you mean that it may be a possibility that this is a reaction to some of the testing techniques, that it wouldn't happen in the environment of the moon itself?
Well, you see, on the moon there's no water. Everything that's being done here in this testing is an aqueous testing system, as far as I understand. And see, if you have an organism, it needs water to be a reacting system. It can't do anything if it's absolutely anhydrous. The molecules can't move around inside it, so it's had it. But if you give it water, then we have the question of the water reacting with the lunar material. Now, of course, they don't use just water. They use certain media, and these media will react with the lunar material. And then you've got a further complexity because you don't know what these products are.
I'd like to respond to that if I could. Oh. Don't
mind. Sure.
Not only that, but it works the other way around also, and that is that a microbe that might be on the moon would not necessarily be killed by the lack of water, but he wouldn't go anywhere either. He would not be able to grow. So he may be able to reside there, but he would not be. We can't show that he'd be killed by the methods that we demonstrate because it does require water, but he wouldn't grow either.
The bacteria wouldn't even be on the moon in the first place because there'd be no water. Is that it?
No, that's not
so
what I said.
So he couldn't be there
he
to be
killed.
He
could be there, and he could be reasonably happy for a bacteria, but he wouldn't be growing, and he wouldn't be dying.
there's one little experiment somebody reported today in which he'd taken glass beads and bored little holes in them and stuffed them full of live microorganisms. He then impacted them at high velocity, roughly equivalent to sort of perhaps lunar arrival velocity, and found, believe it or not, that 1/10,000th of the population survived in a viable state. So that the inference is that if you have meteorites, if you did have them with living organisms in them from somewhere else that have just sort of managed to survive wherever they've come from and the journey, then they would survive the impact, sufficient anyway to lie around on the surface of the moon, as you say, waiting to be revived by water.
My second question was, you mentioned that small amounts of methane, 3 parts per million, and you were going to say the problem is how they got there. What are some of the possibilities of how methane got there?
Well, there's quite a bit of argument about this. The premise that we at Bristol set off with was that if you have carbon atoms and hydrogen atoms coming from the sun, and which everybody, I think, would agree with, when they arrive and hit the lunar surface, something can happen. Maybe they would form methane, since the hydrogen is in vast excess. So that's one possibility, that it's formed in the lunar surface by the carbon and hydrogen from the sun. It could also be that it is formed from carbon actually in the lunar surface, again by hydrogen from the sun. Another possibility is that it was originally in the rocks as they crystallized and has still stayed there. It didn't get completely beaten up by the conditions of crystallization. Let's see, how many more can we think of? I think those are two to be going on with. Another one is, yes, you can hydrolyze the carbides if you generate water on the moon in sufficiently small quantities. And this you can do by having protons arrive and take the oxygens of the silicate matrix, form hydroxy groups, which then might hydrolyze the carbide. It's a bit far-fetched, that one, though, I think.
Two over on this side, and then we'll come back over here.
Yes, Dr. Taylor, I think Pseudomonas is... There's a lot of medical interest in that since it's a virulent organism. Is there any speculation or thought or interest in looking into this as a possible bactericide for medical use?
Well, you have the same problem here that we mentioned before, the mining of gold or whatever, it's not a very profitable adventure. And I don't think that there's any reason at all to pursue that. Now, mentioning that organism, we did pick that organism because it's an extremely hardy bacteria, and it is used as a test organism for disinfectants. So it's not something that's easily killed by something that happens to be lying about.
Is that the only organism you've tested so far?
No, we also used Azotobacter vinelandi, which is a common soil microorganism. The reason we use that is obvious, if it lives in the soil. And we used a Staph aureus, which is also of medical importance and is also used to test disinfectants.
What happened?
They all died.
All three.
Did you have a related question, Mark?
Yeah. What do we have that would kill these things? Could you compare the effect of this to some sort of a betadine or something like that?
Well, one of the things that comes to most people's mind is heavy metals, which we certainly have an abundance of. But the problem there is to show that we have either a higher concentration of heavy metals in this 11 core material than the others, or that we have the heavy metals that are more available for some reason or other in the 11 core than in the 11 fines or the 12 sample, since it was the 11 core was the only one that killed the bacterium. And we did a chemical analysis of this and did not really come up with any significant difference.
It was 11 or 12
core? 11 core from Apollo 11.
That was the
toxic material. Did I say 12 when I went through it before? Okay. If I said 12, that's a mistake. It was the material from the core from Apollo 11, which, by the way, is both cores from Apollo 11. Our sample came from a longitudinal section from both cores, which was mixed up together, unfortunately.
John Lennon.
Do I understand you to be saying that your current supposition is that this bacteria or this biocidal effect is a result of the chemical manipulation rather than something which may be in the lunar material in itself? In other words, using the use of an aqueous solution to form an organo.
Now, we've had enough controls built into this that we know that it comes from the lunar material somewhere. Now, we do not get this toxic reaction unless you treat it in the proper manner. So in this respect, it is a result of the manipulation. You have to take the lunar material and incubate it in contact with a protein solution for a long period of time. And then when you separate the fluids from the fluids are toxic.
What type of protein solution?
Well, this is a very complicated thing. We call it a tryptocase glucose yeast extract agar, which means it's got ground up dead yeast bodies in it, and it's got glucose, and it's got a tryptocase solution. It's a very complex thing.
Dr. Taylor, you were saying a moment ago it would not be worthwhile looking for this toxic agent in large quantities. Surely your work might be, if you're lucky, be similar to the discovery of penicillin, that you find one aspect of it and could later on, knowing the details, how the scandium or whatever metal it is, synthesize it here on Earth and use it on a large scale.
That's a possibility.
Thomas Hull.
You're saying that there's no difference in this core sample chemically from a lot of other samples which you tried and were proved not to be toxic?
Well, to be exact, we found that there's about 28% more scandium in this sample. Scandium. And there is, let me get the exact figure here. There's, I think it's 14% more nickel. But, and we're investigating the effect of scandium on this. But even 28% is not, in my estimation, a large enough difference to go from a completely normal growth curve to killing the things in 10 hours. You see, we start with a pretty good-sized population. You have like 100,000 microorganisms per milliliter, and 10 hours later you have none left alive, which is quite a bit different than a normal growth curve.
Scandia.
Scandium?
Scandium, yeah.
Would one of you gentlemen like to help me out on that?
That's an element. It's an element similar. It's not a rare earth, but it's similar in chemical properties to the rare earth. It's slightly heavier than titanium.
It's element number 21.
Yeah, atomic weight 45 or something like that.
Let's go back here, Ed DeLong.
Could you compare this, the potency of this bactericidal effect with some terrestrial or you know, readily available disinfectant or something like this?
How about a mouthwash? Now, I have not done this. We have a very simple test that we call a phenol coefficient that I could run on this particular organism. But not having run the test, just off the top of my head, I would say it is as toxic as a mouthwash. Now, since there's all kinds of mouthwashes, you see, that doesn't mean anything.
Hey, Mark, I don't know.
Have you tested it with any organisms which it has not killed, besides
no,
yourself?
No, we have not.
Well, I mean, are you working right up to today? Or keep looking for things that it won't get, or what?
You know, when you work with lunar material, pretty soon you run out of lunar material. And we have reported this to NASA management, and if they want to pursue this further, well, it will be pursued further.
Okay, let's get these three right down the middle here, and then I think that'll about do it.
Dr. Taylor, a kind of double barrel question. You said you ran some tests looking towards the possibility of heavy metals killing these organisms. What other areas have you pursued that were either apparently unsuccessful? And secondly, how do you have any idea as to why this particular core sample, as opposed to fines or some other core samples, would be toxic?
Well, the first battery of tests that we ran naturally was a test on ourselves. That's the first thing you always think about, what did I do wrong, you know. And so we've run all kinds of controls and backtracking and retests to make sure that somebody didn't drop it somewhere or something like that. These all showed that it was, in fact, something that was real. We have tried to heat the material 80 degrees for 1 hour, and the effect does not go away. And this is a very important factor because many toxic effects are degraded considerably by that temperature. Outside of that, we have not been able to track it down very much. We got to a point, frankly, where we arrived at the conclusion this isn't just some simple high load of some common heavy metal. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And so we stopped at that point to see if we did want to pursue it further, and if yes, what route we would take. And that's where we are right now.
No speculations why this was particularly good. Chemically, basically the same as the other.
That's right. But once we find out, we have a nice assay system for whatever that thing is.
Art Hill.
Dr. Eglinton, I'm wondering if you and your colleagues are ready to give up on life or the precursors of life or organic compounds on the moon of the type you're looking for, or whether there is still some hope for the future Apollo missions like 14 and 15 to find something.
Well, the answer to that is that with all material that's returned, one must treat it as if it's a new material, because we have no right to assume that all sites on the moon are going to be the same. And there are already plenty of indications of this, because you have people reporting peculiar materials like the famous, what is it called, Kuki rock, the 13 or whatever, and then you have magic components. You have this small fragment of the C2 carbonaceous chondrite that I believe John Wood has reported, though I wasn't afraid of that talk.
Now, if there are small fragments of these things which are relatively undamaged, then they do carry a load of organics, we know, from terrestrial experiments with returned chondrites that have come in, although there's always a great problem about contamination there, more so than with the lunar samples. Now, therefore, we all live in hope, if as organic chemists, that we're going to find, or, I mean, not we, but our friends up there are going to find a nice, juicy piece of carbonaceous chondrite. But we think this is a pretty forlorn hope. What we think is more realistic is that we're going to find ways of pulling out the things that really interest us. And secondly, we hope that missions can go to sites that are of particular interest to the organic chemists. Now, one possibility would be a nice site where a rather low-velocity carbonaceous chondrite has impacted, if one could decide where that was. But being more realistic, one wants to go to colder areas and to go to deeper depths and all the rest of it. So, no, we should not give up, because somebody must maintain a monitoring of this situation, and B, we have every right to believe that we are going to find more interesting materials.
I think on that note I'd like to end it. We could have any other burning questions, that John? right up here, if we. Paul, did you have one too? Okay.
Dr. Taylor, having beaten your bugs to death so far, I'm just wondering, when you do a post-mortem on them, whatever it is you do, do you find an overabundance of the heavy metal or the scandium in the critter's remains? Is it a Is there something that is identifiable as an unusual remnant at the wake, so to speak?
No, we don't. We have to do two things, actually. First, we have to wash them off and see if they survive, if they respond, so we know whether it's a bacteriostatic or a bactericidal effect. And we have found it does, in fact, kill them. Getting to your point, we do not find any abundance of any material, but that isn't really too surprising, because you're talking about, first of all, a real complicated gamish of things that we put this in, the dead bodies of the yeasts and all that, and then you've got the dead bodies of the bacteria, and it's pretty hard to find some little trace material in that kind of a substance.
Thank you very much.